Hello and welcome to Love the Agent, your new favorite podcast for all things real estate. Introducing your host, Alexandria Bolton. Alex is the principal broker of Hippo House LLC. She's been practicing real estate for over 15 years. Licensed in Kentucky and Florida, Hippo House offers commercial, residential, and management services. You can find out more at lovetheagent.com.
Hello, real estate podcasters. Thank you for tuning in to this last episode of Love the Agent podcast. This is our season finale. I apologize for my delay in delivering this content to you. I promise it won't happen again, and in order to avoid that, I am going to binge work and drop seasons at a time. I look forward to discussing what our expectations are for next season at the end of this episode and hope that you'll join me in finding out more information.
So I'm here today with Kevin Campisona, who is a licensed CPA since 2002. He is my personal CPA, he is my parents' CPA, and he's the greatest CPA that ever existed. And he is...
You only say that because you don't know any other CPAs. Thank you.
That's true. So since so much of real estate has to do with money, I think it's super appropriate to bring on a licensed CPA to answer some questions that myself, fellow investors, and homeowners have been dying to ask. Accounting for real estate can involve capital gains, bookkeeping, write-off expenses, etc. And this is a common shortfall for real estate investors, myself included, because we are usually the builders or the visual artistic people and not the numbers people. So Kevin's here to lend some advice.
That's right. Accounting gets a bad rap. We get called bean counters, but the importance of keeping good records is not only for tax purposes, but it's to make business decisions. And it's hard to make business decisions unless you know where you stand. Now, if I ask you, Alex, what did you do last January? From a financial standpoint, you might struggle to remember. You might misremember something. You might not remember everything. But if you've kept up with your records throughout the year, then you can go to that. And you don't have to keep trying to keep all that stuff in your head. Get it on a piece of paper, and it's there for you to look at, to use to make decisions, to share with your CPA or your financial advisor or whomever you're working with to help make better decisions. So it's not all about taxes. I mean, that's a good byproduct that you're ready for that because you have to do that every year anyway, but it helps you make business decisions.
That's a really, really, really good point. Okay, so I just want to take a quick second and disclose to everyone that Kevin, first of all, you're licensed in Kentucky, I believe, but is a CPA, is that something that goes state by state?
Well, yeah, each state has their own society, and that's where you get your certification or license, but it doesn't restrict you to practice only in the bounds of Kentucky. I have plenty of clients in Indiana. I have clients in Tennessee, Utah. Thanks to the internet, you can service clients and get documents back and forth very easily. So there's no restrictions as far as where I can practice.
That's interesting. And that is so dissimilar to real estate agents and attorneys, correct?
Correct.
Huh. That's something to keep in mind when you're considering a career choice and lifestyle choice. So you've been doing this since 2002, but you were telling me that you did it prior. In what capacity?
Well, I joined a public accounting firm in 2000. After working in our family business for 11 years, and I had to sit for the CPA's exam and pass the exam. And I passed the exam in November of 2001, and it just takes the state a little while to get around to licensing people. So
yes,
I've been in the tax profession since 2000, but I didn't get my license until 2002.
20 years, 21. Woo, crazy.
I'd like to say that's where all these gray hairs came from, but that was my teenage daughters. So
they'll do that. First, I want to start talking about taxes for homeowners and what they can expect. I think a lot of my clients are unaware of anything pertaining to taxes in their personal home. So let's start with capital gains. What are they, and when are you required to pay them?
Okay. Well, capital gain is the gain or the profit from any investment that's sold or real estate that's sold. And that includes your personal residence, but there are some exceptions to that. And capital gains get their own name and special treatment because they're taxed at different rates. So within the umbrella of capital gains, you have short-term capital gains, which are any gains that that you have on something you've held in for less than 1 year. That's a short-term capital gain. And that's
so like a flip?
Well, that's a flips are their own animal. We'll get to that in a little bit.
Okay.
Later. So anything you hold for less than 1 year is considered a short-term gain. And that gets taxed at whatever your ordinary income tax rate is on your tax return. So if you're in the 24% bracket and you sell some stock, let's say, that you've held for 9 months and you had a gain on that, that gain would be taxed at 24% at the federal level because it's a short-term capital gain. Now, if you held that stock for a day, a year and a day, it would be considered long-term and it would be taxed at 15%.
Hmm.
You still want to designate something as a short-term gain because a short-term gain can be offset by a capital loss where ordinary income cannot be. So I'm getting kind of deep in the weeds on taxes here, but that's why there's a difference under the umbrella of capital gain of short-term and long-term because the losses can net against one another.
Okay. So going back to a classic homeowner position, their capital gains are usually a long-term play because they have to hold it for at least 2 years in order to not pay the capital gains tax on their primary residence. Is that correct?
Correct. So the rule is if you can exempt up to $250,000 of gain for a person filing single, $500,000 for a married couple filing jointly. If you've lived in the house or the house has been your primary residence 2 out of the last 5 years. That's a requirement. So if you've lived there for more than 2 years and you sell it for a gain, you don't have to pay any tax on the gain. In this part of the country, the $500,000 exclusion covers most people, right? Very few people have that kind of a gain built up in their personal residence unless they've lived there for maybe 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
If you go out to the coast, California, go up to New York, Connecticut, some of these places where property values have really, really inflated, people can get over that threshold pretty quickly,
mm-hmm.
especially if they've lived in a house for 20 years. But in general, in this area, this part of the country, if you sell your house, if you've lived in it for more than 2 out of the last 5 years, you're probably not going to be paying any income tax.
And just to be clear, isn't the rule that it doesn't have to be 2 consecutive years, or does it have to be consecutive years?
No, it's 2 out of the last 5. So you can live in it in 2020, move to Florida for 3 years, come back and live in it in 2025 and sell it. You've met the requirement of 2 out of the last 5.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Where would like Bitcoin fall? So if I were investing in Bitcoin and I sell it within a year, that's going to be a short-term gain that I'm taxed at 24%. Whereas if I held it for over a year, it'd be 15.
Well, yes, if you held it for over a year, it'd be 15. If you sell it in less than a year, it's short term. And that's going to depend on what tax bracket you're in personally on your personal income tax return. It could be if you didn't have any income and that's all you did that year, you could be in the 10% bracket. Or if you had a really, really good year, you could be in the 35% bracket. So there's the range that it falls under.
Okay. And what does that have to do with the homeowners writing off that capital gains? Does that have any impact on it? Like, does your income affect how much? No.
No. There's no income limitation on that. The only limitation or requirement is the 2 out of the last 5 years that your primary residence.
Interesting. Very, 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 very interesting. Because I'm always thinking, and I helped a friend of mine sell her house, and she cashed out $100,000. It was her primary residence, so she won't have to pay taxes on that?
Correct.
Mm. I think she needs a CPA, Kevin. I don't know if you're taking on new
Probably
people.
Not. Probably not.
Yeah. That is all very, very good advice. I think that's why I think it's important for people who have a leg up in this industry, like the real estate agents or designers or flippers, to be relocating about every 2 years, because it's almost a shame not to if you have the ability to make money in this industry and you wouldn't have to pay taxes on that. Is that a good?
That's, well, you know, A, you have to have the temperament to want to move every couple of years. And some people love it, right?
Yeah.
Some people need a change of scenery, and that's great. It's not, but it's not for everybody. I have my cousin, who's a builder, who did this for years, would find a place, say, in Indian Hills, fix it up with his crew while he was doing other stuff. His wife would decorate it. It would look like a showpiece, and they would make a killing. And it was all tax-free. And they did this
over and over.
They probably did it 5 or 6 times within a 15-year period. And again, some people, you know, moving's a hassle for a lot of people. They don't want to do it. But if you have the temperament to do it, it's an incredible way to build wealth.
Yeah. That's what I'm trying to really instill in young people, is how beneficial real estate can be to building wealth.
And the same thing can be said for, you know, rental property. If you have a fourplex, let's say, and you have 4 people in there and they're making your monthly mortgage payment, they're paying for your property, they're covering all your costs. Even if you're just breaking even and not making anything right now, they're paying down your debt, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And in a long-term play, it's a great way to build wealth, because typically the real estate appreciates, the debt goes down, so you're accumulating this spread, and typically the tax consequences of that year over year are very minimal.
Yeah. It's like real life Monopoly, isn't it?
It is.
Look,
it is.
Did you know I have a Monopoly tattoo?
Very nice. I like that.
So right now it's just a blank blackout. Well, it's a black outline of a Monopoly house, but when I get enough houses to make it a hotel, I'm going to paint it red.
There you go. I like it.
So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to go over taxing for flippers and flippers that want to do it in an entity and personally, all the things pertaining to flipping. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Nyport Media, your one-stop shop for podcast production. Find out more at nyportmedia.com.
And we're back. So Kevin, let's get into taxes for flippers. This is something you have to explain to me repeatedly every year. But if you don't mind, okay, we'll have record of it this time and you can just reference me back to the podcast. So let's start with some basic questions for people. When would you want to flip under your personal name or an LLC?
Well, I would recommend, I'm not an attorney, but I would recommend that if you're going to get into this, and it's only you that's going to be involved, or you're not going to have a partner, you're not going to have anything like that, go ahead and set up what they call a single member LLC. So you would register in the state of Kentucky, you register with the Secretary of State. So that provides you the legal protection. It creates a separate legal entity. And so by doing that, you want to run all the income and expenses of that flip through that LLC. So that separates that project from your personal assets.
And
that's so if something were to go wrong with, say, they found asbestos in the, or something
within
crazy,
so people get a year after a sale to file suit. And I've had this happen. Right. So let's say something, you know, the siding fell off and they think you're to blame. They file suit against this entity. Take it away.
Correct. And the only thing they can get is what was in the entity, which at that point in time is nothing, because you've already sold the property. You've taken the funds out and transferred them back to your personal name or put them into another project. So it helps insulate you, the flipper, from potential liability.
So
down the line.
And for our listeners, one thing that I have done and I've seen other investors do is hold I had done it previously, like per partnership, but I'm trying to do less partners. So now it's more like going to be a batch of properties is what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to do like 3 properties under one maybe, and then try to wrap it up just for the liability reasons, because I've already had it protect me, and it's the smart way to go. You got to plan for your success.
Exactly. And so Now, while the state recognizes that as a separate legal entity, for federal tax purposes, the IRS considers a single member LLC as a disregarded entity, meaning you don't have to file a separate tax return. You just report all the income and expense on your own individual tax return, which saves the taxpayer the expense of having another return prepared. Now, where that goes off the rail is if you and I become partners and we want to start doing this, then we would have to file a separate tax return, and then the income would flow through that partnership or that LLC to each of us individually, and we're still reported on our individual return. But since it's going to more than one place, you can't just file it on one return. You got to file it on a return to the IRS, and then it gets divvied out to the partners.
And people would expect to receive a Schedule K in that situation if there are multi-members in an LLC. The document that you would get from the LLC would be a Schedule K. Is that correct?
That is correct. And that would be reporting your share of income and loss for that entity. And that would be reported straight on your individual return.
And you can allocate who put in more money. So if somebody's doing all the financial burden and somebody else isn't, the Schedule K is how that is reflected per each person individually through the entity. Is that correct?
Well, that goes back to the partnership agreement or the operating agreement. You can structure it any way you want to.
Good point.
And have it pretty much do anything you want it to do. But in absence of it telling that in the document, then there are rules that it reverts to based on IRS code. And that's basically, if you put money in, you're the first person to get money out until everybody's equal. Mm-hmm. Or if you put money in and there's losses to deduct, you get to deduct those losses before anybody else does, because you're economically at risk and you can take those losses.
Yeah. And just for people getting started on this, so Kevin, you mentioned how you would go on the Secretary of State to create the entity. And we've discussed now a single member LLC versus a multi-member LLC. There are other options, and I want to come back to questioning you on those, but I wanted to tell people what else they might need to set up is after you get an entity on the Secretary of State, you're going to need to apply for the EIN online. Do you have any comments on when doing that?
The most important thing is to make sure that you get the approval from the Secretary of State that the name you have selected is available. I just had an instance where a client applied for that, didn't wait for the response from the Secretary of State, went ahead and had me get an EIN number for him. Well, that name wasn't available. So now the IRS is looking for a return for an EIN that doesn't, for an entity that doesn't exist in the state of Kentucky, because it's already been claimed.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to write a bunch of letters. And so first thing to do is make sure the name's available, get the approval from the Secretary of State. And once you do that, you can go to the IRS website, irs.gov, and look for where to apply for an EIN number. It's very simple. You can walk right through it. You don't need to pay an attorney to do that or anybody else to do that for you.
And
very simple.
And then if you're a single member entity, a bank does not require an operating agreement typically. But if you are a multi-member LLC, then the bank usually requires an operating agreement, that article from the Secretary of State saying that you're in business, and your EIN number. So that's kind of the three things that you need in order to go start running funds through an LLC pertaining to flips: Secretary of State articles, EIN, and a bank account.
And I would strongly suggest that if you're going into a multi-member LLC, that you have a operating agreement in place that everybody agrees with, everybody's reviewed.
Everybody's signed
and try to cover as many situations as you can think of, because, you may be going into business with your two best friends from grade school, and you've been lifelong buddies. But you never know, this person may get a divorce and may want to get out. This person may have a gambling problem and, try to be taking money when you're not looking, or money makes people do crazy things. So even though these people might have been your best friends since third grade, try to line all that stuff out so it doesn't just, oh, I trust him or I trust her. She would never do that. You never know what somebody's going to do.
Yeah. Yep. We've been through like 10 entities together at this point. the last time I called you, I remember saying, oh, Kevin, I've figured out I really need to organize all my stuff and I just need one more entity to do it. So what happens when funds are out on a project, a flip project that has not sold and the year turns over? What do you file? Like, I've got money out of pocket on this house and it hasn't sold yet, but I've got, you know, 20 grand out on it or something. What do I do with that?
Sure. Well, that money sits in basically the basis of the property, right? And when I say basis, your basis is what you pay for the property plus any improvements you make to it, right? Mm-hmm. So if you buy a house for 50 and you put 50 in it to fix it up, to sell it, your basis is 100. So anything you sell that house for above 100 is profit.
Makes sense. Right?
So at the end of the year, if you still own the property and it hasn't sold yet, then all those expenses just go towards the basis of the property and you deduct them when the property sells. No, because it wouldn't make any sense to deduct those expenses in 2020 and then turn and recognize this loss, then turn around in 2021 and sell the property and have this huge gain, because you already took all the expenses the year before.
So you're not necessarily paying taxes on those costs as income because they are being allocated towards the base.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So it's if you think of it as inventory, so a car dealer buys a car in November and it sits on the lot. He pays $10,000 for it and it sits on the lot and he doesn't sell it till February and he sells it for $15,000. Well, he's not going to deduct $10,000 in 2020. And then recognize $15,000 income in the next year, that's just gonna kind of carry over. And it's called the matching principle. It's matching the income with the expense.
Okay, that makes sense. This is a fun question. What all can you write off with flips?
Okay, well, just a flip, just like any other business, is any expense that's ordinary and necessary to run the business. So mileage. Right. So you have to go to the job site, make sure things are going on. You may have to go to Home Depot or Lowe's or something to pick up something, or the tile place to pick out tile. Track all your mileage as business mileage, or track all your mileage so you can determine your percentage of business mileage versus personal mileage. And I strongly recommend getting some kind of app. I use an app called Mileage IQ.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
So anytime my phone's with me, it tracks. It tells me where I went, where I started, and where I went, and how many miles it is. And it says, is this business or personal? And all you do is swipe one way or the other. And then you get a report at the end of the month that you can download into Excel. And then it's really, really simple. Nobody ever goes anywhere without their phone anymore, right?
Yeah. Can I just tell the IRS that my personal motto is never not working?
You can. They won't believe you, but you can tell them that.
True.
Have you ever heard, Alex? You ever heard the term "pigs get fat and hogs get slaughtered"?
No, that's a good one.
Don't be a hog.
Good point. Good point. I don't do any meals and entertainment, if that helps.
Yeah, well, that's not worth it.
No, it's not. One question that I had specifically was, what about like staging stuff? So I, to me, materials at Lowe's is very obvious, but like getting towels at Target for the staging at the end seems less obvious as a business expense, although I consider it completely necessary. And I do write those off. But for me at this point now, I also do staging professionally with B&B stuff that it totally makes sense. I just am wondering, if you're doing flips, like, do you think that those things would get flagged? Is that less of a concern and probably fine?
I wouldn't consider it a concern at all. That's an expense you deem necessary to sell the property, right?
Yeah.
The property is going to show better, you know, because a lot of people go into a property, they can't envision what it's going to look like with their stuff in it. So you have to put some stuff in there so they get an idea. Oh, that's where I could put my couch. Or, oh, that's where the TV would go. Oh, that's what the bathroom looks like when it. So no, that's, you know, it, as long as you're not taking those stuff and then using it personally.
Yeah.
When it's done.
Getting animal crackers.
That's where you would potentially run into an issue.
Yeah. Couple more quick questions on the flipping for taxes, and then we're going to move on to the third segment of our show. So what approximately, and I guess I bet your answer is going to be, it depends on your earned income rate personally. But the question is, what is the expected tax rate for profits earned on a flip approximately?
Okay. Well, when you start doing flips, you're moving from the realm of real estate, like rental real estate investment, which is considered passive by nature by the IRS, to an active business. So instead of being reported on Schedule E, which is the rental side of it, it's going to be reported on Schedule C as a business. So it's going to be subject to ordinary income tax rates. To your point, whatever bracket you're in, whatever the profit you show from that, it's what it's going to be taxed at. But in addition to that, you're now self-employed. So you're not only paying income tax, you're paying employment taxes. And since you're self-employed, you're paying both halves of Social Security and Medicare. So whatever tax bracket you're in, that's the tax rate. Then you're going to add an additional 15.2% for self-employment tax on that. So this is a big hit that people aren't expecting, because they think, oh, it's real estate, it's going to be a capital gain. No, you're in the business of flipping houses. So this is a business, and that's how it's going to be taxed.
Bummer answer.
Yeah, sorry to rain on your parade, but that's, there are advantages to having things on Schedule C. And let's say you have a bad project and it's a big loss, you can write all that loss off. Mm-hmm. There's not limits on the amount of loss that you can deduct. I mean, that's not a really good situation.
I know, I was like, I guess that's the silver lining.
But rental losses can be limited depending on various things. But
and what would the Schedule E, you just mentioned that, and I didn't realize that. What is the difference in the tax bracket that you might expect on the Schedule E side?
Well, Schedule E, it's going to be the same as far as in whatever bracket you're in, the profit you show from real estate is going to be taxed at ordinary rate. But it's not subject to self-employment tax. You're bypassing that 15.2%. That's the main difference between the two.
Okay. What about an Airbnb, I wonder?
That's a business.
Is it? But what if you don't manage it and you just collect a payment on it?
If you don't manage it, then that would be reported on Schedule E and be considered passive mm-hmm. income, because you're not actively involved in doing it.
So Bliss is my Airbnb management company that I started earlier this year. That my clients, it's Schedule E to them, whereas it's Schedule C for me.
Correct.
So mine is subject to employment tax and theirs is not.
Correct.
All good things to consider. okay, really, this is the last quick question. Do you pay quarterly for flips on expected income?
It is wise to do that because, you know, you have the cash available to you to pay the tax.
Assuming you have the cash available to you to pay the tax now.
Well, I mean, if you made money on the flip, you should have some cash available.
No, I mean, like, so if I'm in the middle of a project and I expect it to make me $40,000 in the third quarter of this year, am I paying, you know, first quarter and second quarter based on assuming that I'm going to get $40,000 for the year off of that property?
If that's your only potential gain or profit on flipping, I would say no, wait until it occurs, because in theory, you're supposed to pay your quarterlies equal and timely and equal amounts. But there's a form you can file with your return saying, okay, yeah, for the first three quarters of the year, I didn't make any money and it all hit in the fourth quarter. So I shouldn't have to have paid all year long. I paid the money in when I earned the money.
What form is that?
Well, it's part of underpayment of estimated tax form. It's like the third page down. Mm. It's not many people know about it or do it.
They will now, Kevin.
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, a lot of times I'll do it for people. I just don't even tell them I did it.
That's good.
It just saves them money, and they don't really care that what form it was, just to do it and save me some money.
While they hired you.
That's right.
Okay. Well, with that, we're going to take a quick break and we're going to come back and talk about an even more in-depth version of investment financing.
This episode is brought to you by Nyport Media, your one-stop shop for podcast production. Find out more at nyportmedia.com.
And we're back. So let's talk about what is a 1031 exchange.
Okay. Well, a 1031 exchange, 1031 refers to the Internal Revenue Code section. So this is part of the Internal Revenue Code and has been so since 1920s. And the bird's eye view is you can sell a piece of real property. And when I say real property, that's real estate, vacant land, office building, anything that you kind of think of as real estate. And you, if you do it right and follow the steps, you can defer that gain, take all the proceeds and invest in a new property.
Does that have to be a long-term gain or a short-term gain? Does that matter?
It doesn't specify in the code. The kind of rule of thumb is it should be a long-term gain, but it nowhere in the code does it say that specifically.
Okay. So a 1031 is like, if I have a bunch, do you have to create a 1031? Like, how do you say I want to do this?
Okay. Well, so there's, like I said, there are steps you have to go through for a 1031 to be executed. The first step is when you get a contract on the property you're selling initially, there has to be language in that contract that says that you're going to do a 1031 exchange. That's the first step. Second step is you have to find and get a what they call a qualified intermediary, a QI, to hold the funds.
Like an escrow agent?
It's like an escrow agent, but it's a little more involved. And this person can't be somebody you have a pre-existing relationship with. It can't be your current attorney. It can't be your current CPA. And there are folks out there who do this and are insured and, you know, licensed and bonded and all that stuff. So you don't have to worry about it. But it has to be basically an independent third party that you don't have a pre-existing relationship with. So they would get the funds, they would hold the funds, then they would disperse the funds when you find the replacement property. So you as the seller cannot ever have control over the money from the sale. If you do that, then the 1031 is null and void.
Mm.
So you also have to go spend all the proceeds you get from the sale, and you have to go equal or up in debt. Otherwise, you're going to have what they call boot, and some of that will be taxable.
Which would be like leftover money?
Leftover money. Let's see. And the last thing is, once you sell the existing property that you have 45 days to identify the property you want to acquire. Or properties, it can be more than one, and you have 180 days to close. This it's a great way to defer tax. You can do this, you know, multiple exchanges over time and continue to defer tax. It's a great way to build wealth. You know, if you're not paying tax on a transaction, that leaves you more money to invest. And if you're comfortable with using debt in addition to your cash, that increases your loan to value, right? So that increases the amount of debt you can have with the cash you have, which opens up more options for investing. As an agent, wouldn't you rather sell a property at $2 million than $1.6 million? I mean, the commission's better,
mm-hmm.
right? So you're helping your client build wealth. You're saving them tax. You're also helping yourself. You're helping the guy at the bank. He wants to make more mm-hmm. loans, right? This is a win-win-win for everybody.
And this does not pertain to your personal property. This is for investment properties only.
Correct. So you can't do it with cars, boats, your own personal residence, which is a different, we've already kind of covered
mm-hmm.
why that shouldn't be an issue to begin with. But yes, so it's for investment property. And the key takeaway to this is you have to plan for this before you start the process. You can't have a contract, getting ready to go to closing and like, oh, I don't want to pay the tax on it. You need to plan this out. Especially in this tight real estate market, you really should have a properties identified before you sell the one you have.
Mm-hmm. What happens if you can't find a property in 180 days? You get your money and it's like, you got to pay taxes on it.
You get your money, you pay the taxes on it. Mm. Just delayed.
Interesting.
So, I mean, there's no really downside. I mean, you're going to pay the tax anyway. It's worth a shot. But it is a planning issue. Mm. You need to plan for it to make it go smoothly.
And this works on any investment property.
Correct. And you can go from one investment property to multiple. I helped a guy 3 or 4 years ago, sold an office building. He didn't like the office building kind of thing. So, and he had a lot of other rentals. So he bought like 7 individual houses that he rents out. I've seen people go the other way. I've seen him sell a portfolio of rental real estate and go into commercial stuff. Mm-hmm. So then you can do vacant land for a commercial, you know, an office building.
Real for real.
As long as it's right. As long as it's real estate,
interesting,
a real property.
Okay, let's talk about the opportunity zone. I have no idea what this means, but my house is in it.
Okay, all right. Well, opportunity zones were created in the 2018 tax bill that Congress passed. Woo. And the big picture is they're trying to get people to invest in economically challenged areas, right? I mean, buying real estate in St. Matthews is kind of a no-brainer, right? I mean, it's mm-hmm. been there for 70 years. It's probably 70 years from now, it won't look any different than it does now. These areas they've designated need help. They need investment. And so what they put this program in place, and what it allows people to do is take any capital gain, not just from real estate, any capital gain. So if you were smart enough to buy Apple stock 10 years ago, and you're sitting on this big capital gain in Apple, and you think, oh, God, the market's going to go down because the Democrats are going to win and I'm going to lose all my value, but I don't want to pay tax on it either. Well, you could sell that Apple stock and take the capital gain that you got from that and invest in the Opportunity Zone property. And what that does, that will defer the payment of tax for up to 8 years or until you sell the property, whichever comes first. And a bonus to that is if you hold it for at least 5 years, your basis in the property goes up 10%, which reduces your gain by 10%. If you hold it 7 years, your basis goes up 15%. If you hold it 10 years or more, any appreciation on the property between the time you bought it and that when you sell it 10 or years or further down the line, it's not taxed at all. So let's say you invested $100,000 in an opportunity zone. At the end of 5 years, your basis went from 100 to 110. At the end of 7 years, it goes to 115. After 8 years, you have to pay the tax on it. But if you held 10 or more, let's say it appreciated from 100,000 to 250. Say you made a great investment. The area really blossomed. That gain, that appreciation from between 250, 100 to up to 250, that 150 would not be taxable. It's a great opportunity. But there are risks associated with it. I mean, you're going into areas that are unproven, that don't have a track record of having economic viability, and you could just as easily make a bad decision and end up with something that's worth much less than what you put your money in for. So again, this is one of these things that takes some planning, takes some research. You know, of these areas, which ones do I think have the best chance or opportunity of really blossoming? And you can, for Louisville, since we're in Louisville, you can go to louisvilleky.gov and look up opportunity zones, and it'll show you the areas mm-hmm. that these are available.
So it doesn't waive your income tax on businesses that are set up in those areas.
Right.
No, it doesn't waive the income.
That was the tax break.
That would be too good to be true.
Yeah. But, so it's a long-term benefit big time.
Right. And so what they're doing, they're looking for people to free up capital to invest in these areas that have been economically challenged over time.
Yeah.
That's the government's way of trying to incentivize people to go into these areas, redevelop.
Well, it works. Look what the tax effect is having on California right now. People are in New York, you know, so taxes determine a lot more than people care to admit. But I think it's because it deals with preemptive planning, and it's that rich dad, poor dad mentality. And it's really hard to go from poor dad to rich dad and start seeing things from the long-term benefit. But you need to, you got to plan on success.
Well, that's, people don't plan to fail, they fail to plan, typically. And, you know, that's one thing I would like to leave your listeners with is, you know, you need to get assemble a good team. You need a good CPA. You need a good attorney. You need a good real estate professional. You need a good investment advisor overall. And, you know, most of what all of us do is not rocket science, but it is a little complicated, and it and the breadth of what's covered under taxes or what's covered under the law or real estate or investing financial advising in general is a lot. And people have lives, they have families, they have a business, they have a job, you know, they don't have time to learn all this stuff. So you need to assemble a good team to help you make good decisions. And you need to plan ahead. Don't be reactionary. Don't go to your CPA in March and say, hey, this is what I did last year. What can we do about it? The toothpaste is out of the tube at that point in time.
Yeah.
If you want to do something, talk to your attorney, talk to your CPA, talk to your real estate professional before you do it. Is this the best way to do it? What are the tax consequences going to be? Are there things I can do to minimize these? Investing in taxes and real estate, it's all a big game. You just need to know the rules so you can play the game to win the game and play the most effective way you can. Because if you don't know the rules, like in football, if you don't know the rules, you're gonna jump off sides, you're gonna run illegal play, you're gonna do all kinds of stuff.
You're running the wrong way. Right.
You're never gonna be successful. And it's the same thing.
That is the wisest advice that our listeners could receive. A couple small notes that I had written down to leave you guys with as well were things to keep in mind when flipping. Keep all receipts and label your receipts immediately and then file your receipts. That is so important for job costing, which is allocating costs for specific jobs. That is beyond important if you want to be a successful flipper. If you don't take the time to know which materials costs were associated with which property, then you really have no idea what you've earned on a property. Kevin has taught me this. And I also wanted to say, do your bookkeeping at least once a month if you can. It's hard. Or next suggestion was going to be to hire resources. QuickBooks Online is phenomenal. But hiring a bookkeeper and even a remote bookkeeper is a great suggestion. I have not done it yet personally. I've been trying to do so for a year, but with COVID, I'm like, well, I need a bookkeeper after COVID. But the answer is yes. Plan for success.
Exactly.
Well, thank you for coming on today, Kevin Campisano, practicing CPA in Louisville, Kentucky since 2002, and my personal and favorite CPA.
Well, Alex, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it. Maybe we can do this again sometime.
Yes, that sounds wonderful. Listeners, I will be giving you a quick intro into next season and what you can expect. This is our season finale for season one. So thank you very much, Kevin, for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you again for listening to this season of Love the Agent podcast. Next season, we are going to be talking about different approaches for real estate investing from the perspective of a beginner. We're going to go into broad yet detailed applications of how you can get started in real estate. Those episodes are going to include land, home, rentals, flips, wholesaling, foreclosures, property management, short-term rentals, commercial property, and trades of the service. Each episode, we're going to break down details of how you could start as a beginner in this sect of real estate. I'm excited as well because we will also be introducing a new component to the show called Real Talk. We are going to have an anonymous voicemail line for you guys to leave voicemails and give us real life applications of what you are going through emotionally, financially, flippily, investment wise. We want to hear about it. I know it's tough, and therefore it's going to be an anonymous line where you don't have to worry about what people might think of you. If you accidentally say your name, we will beep it out. You can trust us in that. You guys have been an amazing audience. We appreciate you, and we would love to hear from you. Please give us a call and leave us an anonymous voicemail at 502-444-LOVE. Again, that's 502-444-5683. Or you can reach us online at www.lovetheagent.com. Again, that's www.lovetheagent.com. We are available on social media at Love the Agent. Don't be shy. We love to hear from you. Thank you again for tuning in to this season, and we look forward to embarking on a new journey with you all in the next season of Love the Agent podcast, your favorite real estate podcast.